back with 20 minutes, but about 15 issues. Right. I'll try to move quickly here. Let me start with count two, wire fraud. The conviction on that, we suggest, is supported by insufficient evidence.
It would be very helpful to me if, rather than using just the shorthand wire fraud, if we could link the labels to the conduct, so that because your case is really about relationships of charges and time.
All right.
As I understand it.
Well, the government alleged a scheme to defraud by Mr. Lichtenberg, since he brought a lawyer on Kauai, of the woman who had contacted him in order to conduct a real estate transaction and make sure that she got paid. And they charged both mail fraud and wire fraud. The mailing taking place either June or July of 2004, and the wire that was alleged as of September 7th, 2004. And basically what the evidence showed was that Ms. Hyman contacted Lichtenberg. She had an interest in a piece of property on Kauai that she was going to sell. And she wanted to have a lawyer to make sure that her end of it was done. And she paid him for that. She sent him $1,800, which was his fee for doing that. She also made explicit instructions that the proceeds should be wired directly from the escrow company conducting the transaction to her bank in Louisiana. And she provided the name of the bank, the bank transfer information, her account number, and so forth, so that could happen. And she specifically prohibited Mr. Lichtenberg, who had suggested that the proceeds ought to go into his trust account, which might be a normal way for such a transaction to be conducted. But she had specifically prohibited that. And then the transaction took place. What she didn't know, and this was maybe the heart of the scheme, was that Mr. Lichtenberg prepared a letter which instructed escrow as to how to complete the transaction and said that they should transmit the proceeds to him, payable to his trust account. And the letter had a CC to the client, which the escrow officer indicated meant that she understood, I think it was a she, that the client knew about this and it was okay. Well, of course, this was directly contrary to the instructions of the client design. And it was the government's theory that that letter was mailed to escrow, and that was the basis of the mail fraud charge. Lichtenberg testified and said he didn't mail the letter. Hand-delivered it to escrow, and evidently the jury credited his...
Because he was acquitted on that. Yeah.
Exactly so. So then the transaction took place, and the money was... Lichtenberg, he deposited in his trust account, directly contrary to the instructions. Ms. Hyman in Louisiana eventually became concerned, hey, where's my money? And she called Lichtenberg, and Lichtenberg falsely reassured her some fashion, basically saying, well, the transaction never took place, and he thought it was all over, something like that. Then she found out that it had taken place, the deed had been conveyed, the interest had been conveyed, and the money had been given to Lichtenberg, and she was out, stolen, theft. You could call it a scheme to defraud, which it is, but it's really just a theft. And so as schemes to defraud go, it's one of the least elaborate schemes one could imagine, because there was nobody else involved. There was no basis for a conspiracy charge or anything else. So here's the gravamen of the problem with count two, wire fraud. It's that the scheme was done. Lichtenberg had stolen the money.
But now the wire fraud allegedly is what?
The wire fraud is three elements.
No, I'm not asking about what is wire fraud, the conduct that was alleged to be the wire fraud.
A wiring of $100,000 from his trust account to the bank
to
the account.
In Indonesia.
In Indonesia, exactly. Okay. So, but wire fraud requires a scheme to defraud. Okay, no problem there. Number two, this is part one of the problem. Use of the wires in furtherance of that scheme. And then third, specific intent to deceive or defraud the victim of the scheme. So the problem is, to be in furtherance of the scheme to defraud, fraud, the wire transaction has to be somehow a step in the plot to defraud the victim. But the victim had already been defrauded. Her money had been stolen. It was reduced to Lichtenberg's exclusive control at the time the wire went. And this problem wouldn't...
But wasn't his overall objective to get the money to Indonesia?
What's that?
Wasn't the overall objective to get the money to Indonesia? Just all part of the scheme.
Well, you say that's all part of the scheme. That's not what the jury was instructed. The jury was told about a scheme to defraud Ms. Hyman out of the proceeds of a real estate transaction. That had been accomplished by September, before September 7th.
I thought you just told us that he let her know that he wanted the money transferred to his trust account.
That's right. And she told
so her then the next step of it has to be he has to get it out of that trust account in someplace else.
No, but that would be so if she had authorized him to do that. She specifically prohibited him from doing that. She said, you may not put the money in your trust account. It must go directly to me. That was the government's proof. That was her testimony. That was the allegation in the indictment.
I guess my question is, since in furtherance of the scheme, it need not be the essential element of the scheme under Shipsey, just a step in the plot, it doesn't seem to me to be outlandish to suggest that the whole scheme is to have the money in Indonesia for him to use, not to have it in his trust account.
Right.
And therefore, he goes to the trust account, and then he wires it to Indonesia, which is harder to get after, and then he goes.
Now, that's a fascinating theory, though.
Well,
it is not the allocation of this thing.
Well, the indictment is, the complaint says, a series of acts to convince the victim to agree to something contrary to her wishes, get the money out of her hands and out of her reach. That's what
and
that's going to be about.
Completely out of her hands and out of her reach once it was in his trust account.
No, that's not the theory of what a trust account is, as I understand it.
Not as a trust account is properly used, of course not. And it's under some circumstances, the point you're making, Judge Schroeder, I think would be well taken. If we have a lawyer who took money in his trust account in a normal transaction and then stole it, this might be a different case. But here, we know that Ms. Hyman prohibited that. So she was defrauded because he explicitly did the exact contrary to what she had instructed him to do. And, you know, this whole problem would have gone away if he had succeeded in the bail fraud, or if they had alleged some other wire transaction. I mean, there's evidence of telephone calls. This is a self-inflicted wound that the government suffers here, if I'm right about this, because they chose the way to pursue this case. And sometimes choices that one makes in life have consequences.
I guess I am having trouble understanding how the thing, even setting aside the point that the scheme wasn't completed until he got it to Indonesia, I don't see how you can quite say that the scheme was complete. The government says it wasn't complete until it got to Indonesia, but I don't see how you can argue that it was complete when it was in this trust account.
Because the Rood case says a scheme to defraud the victim of money is complete when the defendant pays the victim's money.
Yes.
I didn't say that. It's a decision of court.
But the trust account is a little different animal, that's all.
Well, it's not any different than if he put it into some other account. It's just a question of how he spent the money. If he had taken the money in his trust account and bought a car with it, it's all the same. It's all one. Once the victim has been deprived of the money or the defendant has obtained the victim's money, that's when the scheme is complete. Because wire fraud is not a continuing offense.
If he'd send it back to the victim, the way it normally should be done, or the way a trust account should be utilized, there wouldn't be a problem. She wouldn't have been defrauded.
Well, she wouldn't have any loss. She would have been defrauded in the sense that her instruction provided.
Well, she hasn't out of pocket.
Correct. That's true. But I think the government's analysis in this case is confounded by their view that wire fraud is a continuing offense. Now, in any event, let me move on Now, if I'm right about count 2, then count 3, 4, and 5 go, because those are the money laundering counts. But But if I'm wrong about count two, still counts three and four don't. Five is still viable, but three and four are dead because you can't have money laundering until you have the proceeds of specified criminal activity. And the wire fraud doesn't take place, even under the government's view of the matter, until September 7th. But the money laundering counts, two of them, that is counts three and four, are alleged to have taken place before September 7th. So, temporally, you don't have the completed predicate specified criminal activity that's necessary in order to have money laundering. And so, under any analysis, counts three and four are need to be reversed for insufficiency of evidence. That argument doesn't apply to count five because count five deals with a transaction, transfer that took place after the September 7th wire, which is the triggering event for the completion of the offense in count two. And Congress made it clear that money laundering is a separate conduct, separate offense. It occurs after completion of the underlying criminal offense. So it can't take place before the underlying criminal offense has been completed. And this is, once again, you know, the result of the unanticipated by the government acquittal of count one, because these counts wouldn't be inferred for insufficiency of evidence if the mail fraud charge in count one had been the result of the conviction, but it didn't. So I think I'll move on from that. Now, you turned to shook your head.
I thought you just explained that the reason that he had testified that he didn't mail the letter, he had hand-delivered it, so therefore it wasn't mail fraud.
Right.
But it doesn't mean necessarily that it wasn't.
Right.
Your own position is that it's in contravention of what he was supposed to do.
Well, that's on the insufficiency argument. But in terms of the money laundering counts, if you reject my argument on count two, you still have the fact that as to counts three and four, which charge money laundering, they're charging conduct that takes place before there's a completed offense, before there's specified criminal activity. Because now, if you uphold count two, we have a triggering date when the specified criminal activity is complete, September 7th. But if you have a count three and a count four, which you do, which occurred before September 7th, you don't have the necessary completed crime, which Congress has said is what differentiates money laundering from just being part of anything else. And that's necessary. The Savage case holds that. Numerous cases hold that. There's not even any significant.
The money laundering specifically was which transactions?
Let me see if I can refresh my recollection.
Count three suggests that the funds purchased the travel checks in his name. And count four also says the funds to purchase the travel checks in his name.
And those took place before.
And that money was from?
From her. Her money. We're not quarreling about that. We're just quarreling about the question of whether you have the completed specified other criminal activity, which in the statute specific, it can't just be some kind of fraud or some kind of theft. It has to be, as relevant here, particular federal offense of wire fraud. There are other specified things that could have been, but they're not alleged, and so that's what the statute would deal with here. So let me turn to sentencing quickly. I want to start with the district court's, what I would call, mediation of the restitution between Mr. Lichtenberg and the district judge herself. Sentencing was continued for 15 months after various hearings, and we haven't found any particular case that deals with this kind of circumstance, and so we have drawn what we think is the proper rule for decision from the Bruce case, which involved the district court's discussion with the defendant in the context of a Rule 11 guilty plea. And in that case, as in this case, I think the circuit court felt that the district judge was motivated by appropriate desire in the Bruce case not to, to make sure the defendant knew what he was doing and wasn't doing. And here, the district court, I don't question the district judge's motives or her desire to both see that the time had got as much money back as could be gotten, and that also Mr. Mecklenburg might get some benefit for it. But the danger of that kind of involvement, I think, is manifest.
Well, let me add, what I'm not quite clear on is, if we assume that the district court got over-involved,
right,
more involved than perhaps the ethical standard of an impartial decision-maker ideal would entail, what is the remedy for that?
A re-sentence in front of a different judge, because there are other sentencing errors.
No, but I just asked you about that. You're not trying to affect the conviction.
Not on this point.
No, this all happened after the. This happened.
Yeah, this happened
after the PSR
so
came in.
You want
in.
To send it back for re-sentencing by a different judge?
Right. But this isn't the only sentencing error. But we think this is one. Quite frankly,
What exactly did? As I understand it, what she did was make phone calls from the courtroom.
Well, she did a number of things.
What did she do beyond that?
Prepared a power of attorney for use if.
What's wrong with that?
I don't think the district judge ought to be preparing a power of attorney for the defendant to authorize somebody on his behalf to go to Indonesia and get the money back. The defendant wants to do it, he should prepare the power of attorney, or his standby counsel should, or maybe the government should. And that was all with the view that his standby counsel might go to Indonesia and retrieve his.
Was he represented? He was pro se during this whole thing? Is that the.
Yes. And he had standby counsel.
So
he had a full for a client, if I might think.
Yeah, absolutely.
So she prepared this power of attorney. Yeah. So she did this power of attorney. What else did she do?
Well, she repeatedly told him that the main thing influencing her sentencing was this restitution, or whether she's going to go above the guidelines. It's your power to eliminate that factor, she said. She suggested he might want to talk to the government, because to the extent her loss can be mitigated, that is the victim's loss, that may well affect the argument the government is making, it may well affect what they do. She remarked that there are lots of things going on here, with whether he cooperated, that may affect your sentence, but what if the money isn't there? The district court responded when the government suggested imposing the sentence before the money was retrieved. The government wasn't 100% going along with this program, but they weren't too vigorous in opposing it either. And she said that'll definitely affect sentencing. I don't want a sentence without knowing that we have money in hand. The district court remarked that the money in the Indonesian account was untouchable because he made it untouchable. She told her, if you assist the government in doing this, you will have done something favorable. My question to you is, do you want to tell us about it or not? She talked about the house in Indonesia that was occupied by his in-law. She said, I'm actually appalled by what's going on here. You may suffer a lot more than you're expecting if that's going to be your choice, because it's not your right to do this. And over numerous hearings of 15 months, I think, the district court crossed a line that shouldn't be crossed.
What's your strongest authority for that?
We think the Bruce case, which dealt with the Rule 11 issue, we have found no case similar to
that. So from that, all of that which you just went through,
yes,
how is that manifested in the actual sentence that she imposed?
Well, after all, he did, she gave him a year less than she indicated she was going to originally do, which, I mean, Lichtenberg himself, during the when sentencing finally occurred, he asked, so do I get a downward departure? So my cooperation this past year really didn't do anything for me. There's no diminishment for returning a fund. I presume that's a diminishment of the length of the sentence. Why is that? Returning the money didn't help my cause at all, he remarked. So.
You're right. He had a full
so let me just touch the dish. Let me just say that it needs to be reset for me. But the starting point was wrong. And it's wrong because the vulnerable victim enhancement was improperly applied. And it's wrong because the criminal history was improperly calculated because of a violation catch order, which is similar to contempt that should be used on fines.
Okay, you're out of time. We'll give you a minute on rebuttal if you want to use it. Thank you.
I'll start with the wire fraud.
Could you introduce yourself?
Identify yourself. I'm from the United States. I'll start with the wire fraud conviction. The way that the standard review is before the court is a deferential standard. So we have to look at what a reasonable trier of fact would find. And in this case, for you to do so, you could find, as we believe is the case, that all along this defendant intended to defraud the victim of her money. He intended not just to violate her instructions by putting it in the client trust account, but then to make it unavailable to her by taking it out of the client trust account. And under the deferential standard, that is something that not only could one find, but the jury did find. Here we have a unique form called the special verdict form, which, if you look at it, excerpt of record 569, says, by the way, the jury did find that his failure to notify the victim that the funds were in the client trust account at the same time he made the wire transfers impacted their finding that he was guilty of the wire fraud. So in this case, what we do have is we have steps in a scheme to defraud. And one of those integral steps was the transfer of funds to the client trust account in contravention of the victim's will and wish. But the other step was making the money completely unavailable to her by wiring it out of that client trust account. So it was incident to this scheme, it was also essential to the scheme, and under the Moon case, which we think is very similar to our case, we do have a scheme that would encompass the wire fraud.
Now, I'll address money laundering.
Yes.
Because if we get to that point, then I'm hearing counsel's argument as to money laundering.
Right. So, as counsel correctly said, count five, there's no issue with count five, we consider this a temporal problem. Now, what we would argue, and we think the case law could support, is the finding that there is completed phase of the scheme at the time the money is transferred to the client trust account. The issue is that you want to make sure that the defendant has possession of these funds, that he has obtained them, and that's the problem with the Johnson.
Well, under the federal statute, just let me back up a minute. Under the federal statute, money laundering has to be laundering of the proceeds of a particular kind of crime.
That's correct.
And so the predicate crime here for the money laundering is what?
It's the wire fraud. And it is the scheme and artifice to fraud.
Wire fraud meaning the, not the mail fraud, but the wire fraud meaning the, which wire fraud?
The wire fraud meaning the transaction was initiated on September 3rd and then completed on September 7th. Now,
was that the Indonesia or was that
That's correct. That was the $100,000 that after into the account on September 2nd, September 3rd, was then pretty much immediately transferred out to Indonesia. Now, the problem that the courts have addressed that starts in Johnson and up through Savage is that those were situations where the government tried to double charge. They said, okay, we've got wires, and we're going to charge them both as the wire fraud and as the money laundering. Well, the courts were concerned with that, and they said,
right.
Well, no, you actually have to obtain the funds, you have to obtain the proceeds before
right.
you can actually then engage in money laundering. They have to be separate acts. And in this case, we have a double charge. We have our scheme, we have our wire fraud, we have the use of the wires to further this very long scheme that began at least in July. You could argue maybe began in December when he falsified his passport and intended to move to Indonesia at that point. But at least it continued through September 8th, which we did adequately charge in the indictment.
Was his wife in Indonesia?
His wife was in Indonesia, and by virtue of statements that he made during the course of the proceedings, he had to use that.
Well, does the wire fraud have to be complete before you can have money laundering?
Well, certainly a phase of the wire fraud has to be complete. We think the case law does say that.
What's the best case that supports what you just said?
We can look at Morelli, which is a Seventh Circuit case.
How about, have we addressed the issue?
Well, we addressed the issue in Rogers to some extent. To some extent, what we said in Rogers is that there was a similar situation. We had two counts, mail fraud counts. One was an acquittal, and then we had one account that had been sustained. And what we said, or what was said in Rogers, is that a portion of the proceeds that is then laundered doesn't have to derive from the actual act that sustained the conviction for fraud. So that is the case that we could look to. But there are a number of cases that we have cited. Garlic is a Ninth Circuit case where it says that it's a jurisdictional issue that, you know, once the wire fraud does take place, then the scheme, the artifice to defraud, is in fact the federal crime of wire fraud. But that doesn't preclude finding, as we already can be found, that at the stage the money went into the client trust account, there was completed payment.
Do these two accounts make any difference in the overall sentence?
They don't, because what we do is we look at account five, which is sustained because of it occurring on September 8th after the wire fraud occurred. So then when you look at the $373,000 of loss, that is what motivates the guidelines. So even if the court were not to agree with our premise, the conviction would still stand as to the account five. But
let,
we do think that
let me change, if you could, to if my worry is the criminal history points.
Criminal history points as the order of protection versus the
yes.
contempt of court.
In the guidelines, it suggests that an exception for prior offenses that are similar to contempt of court is the exception. And as I try to read through, while I've been on the court, or on the district court, and I wasn't in the federal district court, on the state district court, and I saw protection orders a little bit differently than I did contempt orders, it seems to me, nonetheless, if I review what Hawaii suggests about them, that they're pretty similar. So why isn't it an exception and therefore not criminal history points?
Well, it is a common sense approach, and in that case, we would argue that the order of protection does have some variations. It's somewhat different because in that case, you are seeking to protect somebody. In this case, with a contempt of court, their elements are not necessarily consistent with the order of protection elements. And so we would argue that, you know, they, under the common sense approach, that they are dissimilar.
However, it seems as if the punishments, guidelines provide prior sentences, you know, what they have to do, and then I look at what we have for the, if you will, the protection orders under the Hawaii law, pretty similar. What they have to do under Hawaii law in order to have these protections orders violated, and what they have to do under the contempt law seem pretty similar. And it seems to me those are tough comparisons to make and not come out that we should have criminal history points here.
Right. Well, as to that issue, we do think that they are somewhat dissimilar. Yes. When you
What's the only thing you could say dissimilar, as I understand it, is one would involve a victim and another doesn't?
That's correct, Your Honor. The order of protection has a different, and that could result in the sentencing, and that could result in the imposition of what.
Well, let's suppose they are similar and that the court made an error. Don't you believe then that the range from 63 to 78 months rather than the 70 to 87 months is enough for us, especially given that the court went above all of the sentencing guideline range based on the 3553A factors? We better send this back.
Well, Your Honor, we would say that if there were miscalculation of guidelines as criminal history, that yes, it would have to be remanded for the correct calculation of the guidelines. We don't subscribe to the position of the defense as to the manner in which the defendant was sentenced or that the court acted with any impropriety during the course of the sentencing proceeding. So leaving aside what the court finds with respect to the counting or the computation of misdemeanors, if I could just address the arguments that were made by counsel as to what occurred during the sentencing.
Well, what effect would it have? I'm not quite understanding under this new regime of sentencing if this resulted in a couple of extra points.
The way the court sentenced and the way that she put forth the 3553A factors, we'd say it wouldn't
make any difference.
It wouldn't make any difference whatsoever.
Harmless error, I guess.
However, don't we have a procedural error and a substantive error? And if we don't have a correct calculation of the guidelines and applying the 3553A factors to those guidelines makes it a little difficult. So therefore, that's why you said if you do find an error on the two criminal history points, we probably ought to send it back.
Right, because I think the case law does say that if there is an error in the calculation of the guidelines.
Let me ask you this. Does harmless error ever apply in sentencing situations?
I think it does apply definitely, and I think in this case probably what would happen is if we go back, she could correctly, if in fact you find that wasn't correctly.
And then give the same sentence.
Give the same sentence.
It would just be sort of exercising utility to some extent, but I think there is a point there. Now, looking at the positional record, there were 13 hearings that occurred, and it's important to take each hearing and to take a look at it for what it was worth. The court, on September 27, 2006, came completely ready and was ready to sentence the defendant to 138 months.
That was the first sentencing hearing.
That was actually the second. The first one had to do with some issues that he had raised, that he had depression and such, and so he had some experts, and that was found out to be relative to the ultimate sentence. But the first sentence where she considered the guidelines, where she considered his objections, and then when we were sort of off to the races, was September 27, 2006. And during that period of time, she went through all the objections, she gave her ruling, she entered into a discussion with the defendant as to why she was ruling in certain ways on these guideline calculations, and then she said, I'm going to sentence you to 138 months because what I feel you have done here is not adequately reflected in the guideline calculations and extends well beyond what you should be facing. She didn't give him any alternative. She said, this is what I'm going to sentence you to. And then after hearing her proposed sentence, if you look through that transcript, he gives another plea for a lower sentence. He says, Your Honor, don't take my life away from me. No remorse, no acceptance of responsibility, no mention of the victim. And at that point, she says, well, I'm going to tell you what's influencing my decision here. And it has to do with the fact that you have not said where the funds are, demonstrating no acceptance of responsibility. There's been obstruction throughout the course of this proceeding. And then it was the defendant, unsolicited, who gets up and he says, well, I don't have her money, which is a lie. All I have is some money that I'm willing to give her, $200,000 in the account in Indonesia, completely unsolicited. Now, what we would say at this point, that's where he makes himself vulnerable to any kind of perjury charge, to any kind of problem that the defense then says happened throughout the proceedings. Now, at that point, she says, well, I'm going to let you talk to your standby counsel. She doesn't say, well, let's see what we can do here so we can mitigate some restitution issues and maybe we can help yourself in your sentence. In fact, from the very beginning, she says, this may or may not affect your sentence. I don't know how this is going to happen, but all I can do at this point, prior to instituting sentence, is give you the opportunity to cooperate and accept responsibility. That's all I can do. Now, it's strange in this case because, in fact, after all of this, after 13 hearings, the defendant is saying he wants to cooperate. He's giving us little snippets of information here and there that the government then has to go and track down. He still gets 12 months off. So it's a question of where he would have ended up in any event. Any judge could have looked at the same factors that the court did look at in the November 6th, 2007 hearing, where she did impose her final sentence, and could still find the same factors. He actually got credit.
You know, I thought it was kind of odd that, maybe not odd, it's the right word, but somewhat different that, you know, she's calling people on the phone in the courtroom. I mean, that's kind of unusual.
If you look, Your Honor, at the hearings that occurred after September 27th, mm-hmm. October 6th, 2006, where she sets down the framework here. She says, nothing short of having the money in hand is going to give you acceptance, responsibility, cooperation. And how can we trust you? How I'm not just going to say that your willingness to cooperate is at the time you say you want to cooperate. Now, it turned out to be a very complicated process to get this money. There's no treaty with Indonesia.
I gathered that.
Had to go on. With respect to him.
They had to talk to the banks, and they had to do this, the consul's office.
Correct, and then we ended up having these diplomatic procedures. If you start at the November 20th hearing, and you go to the April 5th hearing, and then you go through all the subsequent hearings, you see the complexity that we're faced with. Now, the defendant at the time is saying he still wants to participate in this, he wants to get this money back, and the court is, in effect, helping him do that. With the telephone call, the defendant comes and says, well, I can't make telephone calls out of the prison. Well, fine, you can use our phone here and it's there. Now, with respect to the power of attorney, in the end of the day, it was actually the United States that drafted the authorization document. So, looking at the power of attorney, the defendant said, I'm willing to sign it, I will sign it, I refute it, it looks fine. No protest from the defendant. This was something he had initiated, but he was engaging in completely, knowingly, voluntarily. He's an attorney, he waived his right to testify at trial, he knew what he was getting into. And this is something that he was actually pursuing with the court voluntarily because he wanted to, if it turned out and it did turn out his favor, get any credit prior to her imposing sentence. Because there was no mechanism for him to get any credit.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that her interest in getting the money back for Mrs. Hyman, which is so great, that it kind of skewed her ability to make a fair decision here?
I don't think at all, Your Honor. I think if you look at the...
she let it be known how important that was to her.
She did, but through the whole person.
And in the end, they only got back $200,000 or whatever it was. And he lied, and she accused him of lying and withholding, not telling the truth and whatnot.
Right. She did take into account some of the activities
that occurred during that period of time.
Right. Now, I would say that might be a problem if she got above the 138 months that she said she was going to get him at the very beginning. At the very beginning, she says, you're getting 138 months. Now, if at the end of this whole procedure, she'd give him 140 months or something and said, now I'm giving you that period of time because you lied in this whole proceeding. You dragged us through this, and now I'm going to punish you for that. Maybe then we'd have a problem. But his starting point was 138 months, and he ended up with 126 months. So she did, despite the fact that it was a problem getting the money for all these different reasons, did give him credit for it. So it's hard to see what he's thinking his real remedy would be in this case. Any other judge, looking at the same factors that the judge did consider when she ultimately did impose sentence, could consider the exact same thing for the very same reasons. And so there's nothing wrong with the reasonableness of her sentence in the end. And in fact, the fact that he did get less than she originally said he would get at the very outset sort of renders his argument somewhat
incomplete. Listen, he might get more if it went back to a different show. Can I ask you a question about the protective order again?
Sure.
This is a hard record to work with because he was pro se and he had advisory counsel. And at some point in the sentencing, his standby counsel filed a statement on his behalf that commented on about every sentence in the pre-sentence report.
Actually, he drafted that.
He drafted it. Is the point with respect to the protective order in paragraph 63, the defendant states that two criminal history points is absurd for having a broken heart and being locked out of his home after his first trip to Bali?
Paragraph 63.
Yeah.
Yes, I think what the defense is arguing that all of these, there were a number of violations of protective orders, I think, up to more than 10, and then the contempt of courts, there were more than 4. And so with the probation officer, they didn't count all of them. They only counted two groups, and those two groups, they computed to in each instance, equal 1 point. So yes, it is that paragraph 30.
So apparently there was a protective, as I gather, there was a protective order that said that he wasn't supposed to go after his wife and to the house.
That's correct.
And she locked the door, and he apparently got back in or tried to get back in.
That was one set of violations, yes. Those were 8 counts that went to that issue.
Yeah.
And then there were 2 counts that went to a card he tried to send her on Valentine's Day. Those didn't get counted. And then there were a whole other set of counts that had to do with him coming and seeing her orders and talking to her. And then they went to the court and he was found guilty of those counts. So upwards of 12, maybe 14 different counts that happened at different points in time, 3 different case numbers. And then, of course, the contempt courts, the court hearings that took place as well. So he was found guilty of those and was punished separately for those as well, although it all did relate to the same order of protection.
But it was always a contempt of court, correct?
No, they were order of protection. So
he
was found guilty on two separate occasions. In the first instance, 8 counts of order of protection, and then he failed to show up for some of those proceedings, and he got contempt of court charges and violations as well. So there were separate things going on in both of those different proceedings. And then there was a second set of proceedings that he had 2 counts of order of protection violations and then contempt of court violations that were related to that too. So they were distinct. And again, the way the probation office and the report distilled those was into 2 criminal history points. And it did note that there were other violations that didn't count because there were no intervening arrests and stuff like that. So if the court were to consider it, she could still look at the criminal history in total, as she did, and could say that the computation doesn't account fully for how you violated the law.
That would be a 3553A.
under the, right, under those 10.
Are there any further questions? Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Make your best shot.
Well,
briefly.
Okay. Trying to win the whole case. The except for about six. Special verdict actually, because if you look at the statements that were set forth, number three, number one is, this is an inconvertible time if you could not convey the deed to all proceed to greater permission. Two, raise it at 10, have a letter, did not send Hyman this letter, and said to Calgary team was not the wishes of Hyman. Three, Lichtenberg told Hyman and Mr. Becker that all proceeds would be wired to Hyman's bank in New Orleans. This was not done. Four, Hyman acted permission to Lichtenberg to first deposit all proceeds in Lichtenberg's land trust account, and then there's some back and forth with the clerk. I don't understand. I also would have made this very thing if he had in Hawaii and most everywhere else. And five, Lichtenberg did not notify E.H. Hyman that the funds were in the IOLTA account at the time he made wire transfers. So the theft of the money was complete until the wire occurred. So even if you don't win on that, we think we need to be sentenced because the starting point is wrong. I think the law is clear. If the starting point is wrong, even if the judge can get to the same place with the correct starting point, you still have to go back because it's a procedural error. Thank you.
The matter just argued is submitted for decision. That concludes the court's calendar for this morning. The court appreciates the quality of the argument and the case just presented. And the court for this session stands adjourned.
Thank you for your argument. I don't know why it's so high, but...